All right. We're going to be in 2 Kings 15 today. And, not to down the lesson in any way, because there's some interesting stuff. But this is really a transitional sort of chapter. Because we've gone from a period of prosperity, a period of somewhat stability in the region, to the firestorm's about to get stirred up again, and Israel is going to take a nosedive politically, spiritually, everything. You wonder how much lower can Israel get spiritually, but they're going to pull it off here in this chapter. We'll see a king from Judah here at the beginning and a king from Judah at the end, with a bunch of Israel kings in the middle, and you'll see everything. And it's not going well in Judah either, by the way. But really what this does, this chapter is setting us up for the exile to come, which is going to be chapter 17, when Israel finally falls to Assyria. And so there's some political stuff in this chapter, there's some spiritual stuff in this chapter, and you see how ugly it gets with the kings as we move forward in it. Okay, so this is our first section in chapter 15. This is King Azariah. He is a king in Judah. And I meant to bring those little cards for y'all today, and I left them in my office. So if we have time at the end, I'll go grab them. If anybody wants their little king's cheat sheet card, you can put in your Bible. All right, so 2 Kings chapter 15, verse 1 says, "In the 27th year of Jeroboam, king of Israel, Azariah, the son of Amaziah, king of Judah, began to reign." Remember, Azariah is Uzziah, same guy. He was 16 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 52 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Jecholi of Jerusalem, and he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, according to all that his father Amaziah had done. Nevertheless, the high places were not taken away. The people still sacrificed and made offerings on the high places. And the Lord touched the king so that he was a leper to the day of his death, and he lived in a separate house. And Jotham, the king's son, was over the household, governing the people of the land. Now the rest of the acts of Azariah and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah? And Azariah slept with his fathers, and they buried him with his fathers in the city of David, and Jotham his son reigned in his place. All right, so just like Amaziah, just like Joash, just like the kings that were before him, he does right in the eyes of the Lord, and yet he never gets rid of the high places. So it's another one of these kings that is better than some of the other guys, but doesn't do everything that he's supposed to do. Isaiah begins his prophetic ministry during this reign. So if you want to start tying in the prophets to what we've got going on last week in Israel, it was Amos and Hosea who start prophesying in Israel. Isaiah is going to start prophesying in Judah during this time. And when we get to 2 Chronicles 26, we're going to get more information about this king. Chronicles is going to help us out here as we move forward with Azariah. Sorry. All right, so let's look at 2 Chronicles 26, if you want to put a note there to cross-reference, but there's what we have. It says, "But when he was strong, he grew proud to his destruction." This is Uzziah. This is Azariah here. "For he was unfaithful to the Lord his God and entered the temple of the Lord to burn incense on the altar of incense." All right, so big no-no from the king. Who's the only one allowed to go into the temple? You got to be a priest, right? Even into the main part, it's a priest-only area, and then the high priest all the way in. But the king goes in because he's proud, and he does his own sacrifice, basically. Okay? 17, "But Azariah the priest went in after him with 80 priests of the Lord who were men of valor, and they withstood King Uzziah and said to him, 'It is not for you, Uzziah, to burn incense to the Lord, but for the priests, the sons of Aaron, who are consecrated to burn incense. Go out of the sanctuary, for you have done wrong, and it will bring you no honor from the Lord God.' Then Uzziah was angry. Now he had a censer in his hand to burn incense, and when he became angry with the priests, leprosy broke out on his forehead in the presence of the priests in the house of the Lord by the altar of incense. And Azariah the chief priest and all the priests looked at him, and behold, he was leprous in his forehead, and they rushed him out quickly, and he himself hurried to go out because the Lord had struck him." Okay? So the priests try to warn him, "Get out of here right now," and he doesn't leave and has his temper tantrum, and he gets struck with the leprosy. Now, if you remember when we talked about Naaman, about however many chapters ago, remember we talked about how Naaman had leprosy, but he seemed to still have somewhat of a career. He still had somewhat of an existence because it probably wasn't progressed very far. But if he's got leprosy on his forehead, everybody's going to know. And this pretty much ends his ability to be king, to interact with people, to enter the temple compound. He can't even go up on the Temple Mount if he's got leprosy. Okay, so this really effectively kicks him out. And it says in our King's verse that he goes and lives in a separate house. That literally means house of freedom, which means apparently it was a totally separate. He was free from everything in the Jewish community because nobody could interact with him because he was unclean. So he goes from being the king of Judah to being a leper who lives by himself out in a house outside of the bounds of the city. Okay, so it gets pretty bad. It was quite the sin. So Uzziah is forced to live separately, never enter the temple. His son Jotham is pressed into a co-regency to help run the nation. So we see this a lot. Co-regency, Uzziah is still officially king, but his son is the one that's ruling. And his son's 16 years old and comes up to the throne and takes over. So for about a period of time, both father and son are considered king. One just never comes into the temple at all, but he's still, you know, a king. It's kind of like what they did with the high priest during Jesus' time. Okay, so 2 Chronicles 26:21, King Uzziah was a leper to the day of his death, and being a leper lived in a separate house, for he was excluded from the house of the Lord, and Jotham his son was over the king's household, governing the people of the land. So he has been replaced. Okay, so why does he go in and offer incense? And the chronicler says it's because of his pride. He had gotten some victories, he had expanded the territory a little bit, kind of got a little bit too big for his britches, and he went in there and he was going to show what kind of king he was. And you would think, well, that's kind of stupid on his part. Well, yeah, it is really stupid on his part, because the Mosaic law was always there was a king and there was a priest. Now, who's the only one that gets to be both a king and a priest? Okay, yeah, Jesus. Messiah was the only one that was promised to be prophet, priest, and king. You don't get to do priestly things and kingly things. Now, if you go forward in history to the intertestamental period, when the Maccabees show up, the Hasmonean dynasty, the very first thing that they do when they get into power, they combine the king and the priest. And they start doing that exact same thing during the intertestamental period. And there's no wonder that there's no word from God during that entire period. It's very corrupt. There's murders all over the place. When you start trying to change the rules on God's laws, look what happens. It goes down very quickly. And that's how we get to the situation of Pharisees and Sadducees in the Roman Empire in Jesus' time, because of the chaos that happened during the intertestamental period. And if we did it when we covered intertestamental years ago, but if you remember, if you've ever thought about it, think about Joseph, a son of David, in the line of David, and what's he doing? He's a carpenter up in Nazareth. Okay? Why is he not in a higher position? Because that line had been pushed aside when the Hasmoneans came in and they took their own nepotism and power and all that kind of stuff. So this is not a good precedent to set. The king is not to do this kind of stuff. So according to earlier in 2 Chronicles 26, Uzziah defeats the Philistines and the Ammonites. He rebuilds the walls of Jerusalem that Jehoash destroyed. Remember when he came in and took out that section of the wall? And he also benefits from Assyria's problems and Syria's weakness. So he thought everything was great. He was going to expand his power, and look what happens to him. Okay. Just as in Israel, Judah's experienced one of its last peaceful periods. After this, it's kind of chaotic for the most part. Except for when Josiah is in power, a few years with Josiah, the people are basically going to be at the mercy of a foreign nation in some form or another. Okay. With the exception of a few years during Josiah, Judah will be under the thumb of some other nation from here on out, or at least under great pressure from another nation to invade. So it's going to take Judah longer to fall than Israel, but it's going to fall. So what the author is trying to set up for us in 2 Kings is that God's about at the end of his rope of mercy for these two nations. Okay, and now things start to escalate pretty quickly, and none of these are kind to Israel. So just some political background here so you can get an idea of what's happening. Remember, Assyria had risen up years, decades earlier. And then they were kind of beaten back by a coalition, and Assyria kind of calmed down for a little while. Syria had risen up for a while, and that was always a problem for Israel. They had backed off, and everything for about 40 years was pretty calm in Israel. There weren't Syria and Assyria, both of them were staying home, and they weren't invading their lands, and so it was pretty calm in Israel, and everybody thought it was great. That's going to end very quickly. So at just the moment Assyria becomes a conquering nation, they rebuild themselves, and they become that what's eventually going to become the Assyrian Empire and rule this entire region. Israel's going to suffer through a succession of weak kings who come to power usually through conspiracy and assassination. Okay, so the next several kings we've got get there not because they should be there, but because they killed the king that was there before them. And so at the same time, as chaotic as it looks, the sovereign God is at work, and it's that we've said it before, I think, that we kind of get the leaders that we deserve. Sometimes God gives you a not-so-good leader to put you back in your place or to teach you something, or maybe it's judgment, or maybe it could be a lot of different things. But no matter who's in power, no matter how much we disagree with who is in power, God's still sovereign. God still has control over those things, and we got to deal with that inconvenient truth, right? Okay? It'd be nice if he just gave us righteous leaders all the time, but he's not do that. Okay? Anybody got anything while I'm taking my breather? All right. All right, so let's move to, and we're just going to go through these kings fairly quickly because you see they're very short. We're up to 753, 752, so we're about 30 years out of exile, okay, for Israel. In the 38th year of Azariah, king of Judah, Zechariah, the son of Jeroboam, reigned over Israel and Samaria 6 months, 6 month reign. And he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, as his fathers had done. He did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which he made Israel to sin. Shalom, the son of Jabesh, conspired against him and struck him down at Ibleam and put him to death and reigned in his place. Now the rest of the deeds of Zechariah, behold, are they written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel. This was the promise of the Lord that he gave to Jehu, your son shall sit on the throne of Israel to the fourth generation. And so it came to pass. Again, reinstituting God's faithfulness, even a promise to Jehu. Okay, so Zechariah, if you want to kind of trace this, Zechariah's reign is the first step towards ultimate destruction. It is the first step going downhill. We're starting to tumble. The rock's starting to roll. Okay? He's the last king descended from Jehu. Again, God said you're going to have four generations on the throne. He's number four. He's the last one. He lasts a whole 6 months before the next guy kills him and takes over. He's replaced by Shalom, who joins the list of kings who usurped the throne through violence. We've got Baasha, we've got Zimri, Omri, and Jehu. These four guys all assassinated the previous king to become the king, some for better reasons than others. Now we add Zechariah to that, Shalom to that list, who kills Zechariah. And so from here on out in Israel, the kings don't use any other avenue very often. For the rest of the way, a lot of killing to get to the throne. Okay, so we've become just like Israel has become just like all other nations. Because that's what happens in all the pagan nations. You know, it's very Darwinian. It's very whoever's strongest at the time takes over. That's exactly what's going to happen in Israel. Okay, so let's go to the next guy, Shalom. Shalom, the son of Jabesh, began to reign in the 39th year of Uzziah, king of Judah, and he reigned 1 month in Samaria. So we've got back-to-back kings going 6 months and 1 month. Then Menahem, the son of Gadi, came up from Tirzah and came to Samaria, and he struck down Shalom, the son of Jabesh, in Samaria, and put him to death and reigned in his place. Now the rest of the deeds of Shalom and the conspiracy that he made, behold, they are written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel. And if you wanted to see how bad it's getting, look at this guy. At that time, Menahem sacked Tipsah and all who were in it and its territory from Tirzah on, because they did not open it to him. Therefore, he sacked it, and he ripped open all the women in it who were pregnant. Okay? I mean, that's pretty shocking and hideous and horrible. Okay, so because that those other cities did not support him as king, he went in and murdered a bunch of women and pregnant women and killed children and everything else. This is where Israel is going. Okay? You can see the downhill path that we're going on. Okay. Shalom lasts even less times. His 1 month is the second shortest in Israel's history. Zimri was the shortest. You remember Zimri lasted about a week before Omri comes in and burns down the place that he's staying in 1 Kings 16. And it's so short that the author doesn't even acknowledge his achievements or assess his merits. Every other king we've got just about, you know, he did this in the eyes of the Lord, but he didn't do this. This guy doesn't even get that because he was king for so short a time. He didn't even have a chance to do anything of any merit or of any, you know, whatever the opposite of merit is, right? Dismerit. I don't know what you want to say. There's no good. There's no bad. He's just gone because he gets overthrown. One commentator notes that Assyrian records call Shalom the son of a nobody, and that means that he was a usurper that had no right to the throne. So even outside of Israel, people are looking in and going, "Boy, things are messed up in Israel." You know, that before this had never been the case. God had always set up a kingly line. It had been different than all the other nations. And then all of a sudden, we've got people killing everybody left and right and usurpers taking the throne. And even the Assyrians note that they're doing things wrong in Israel. Okay? So Menahem's coup receives more attention in the text than his predecessor's reign. So the fact that he got killed got more attention than him being king in the first place. And some commentators theorize that Menahem may have been a military commander under Zechariah who used support from Tirzah to overthrow his master. We don't really know why he overthrows him, but the military hypothesis is a good one because that tends to be the case in many coups, right? A general that has the support of the troops, that's an easy way to sweep into power because you've got an army at your back. And that usually is, you know, it's not a one-man thing to take out a king because there's always support. So he then commits atrocities against a city that rejects his leadership, and that's what we read about at the end of that section. Okay, so at that time, Menahem sacked Tirzah. Here's that horrible verse about him ripping open the women that were pregnant. Menahem's brutality, as one commentator put it, is unparalleled in intertribal warfare in Israel. There's never been an Israelite king that did this to other Israelites. This is beyond the pale when it comes to behavior in Israel. It really shows a new low. And we're talking about a kingdom that had Ahab as its king. This guy takes it to a whole other level of depravity here, matched only by the Ammonite barbarities mentioned in Amos. So the only time we get horrible visions like this is when pagan nations do it. And now we've got an Israelite king doing this, not to an enemy group even, but to his own people. That's how ugly it's gotten. So obviously Menahem's butchery marks a new low in Israel's leadership, conducts its affairs. All right, it is getting bad. All right, let's move to Menahem and see his reign. Verse 17. In the 39th year of Azariah, king of Judah, Menahem, the son of Gadi, began to reign over Israel, and he reigned 10 years in Samaria, which is about a lifetime considering what we've seen in the last couple kings. And he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. He did not depart all his days from all the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which he made Israel to sin. Pul, the king of Assyria, came against the land, and Menahem gave Pul 1,000 talents of silver that he might help him to confirm his hold on the royal power. Menahem exacted the money from Israel, that is, from all the wealthy men, 50 shekels of silver from every man to give to the king of Assyria. So the king of Assyria turned back and did not stay there in the land. The rest of the deeds of Menahem and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel? And Menahem slept with his fathers, and Pekahiah, his son, reigned in his place. So what's the memory for this king? What does he do? Obviously, he's not doing the right thing, but what's the big thing that he does that could be a mistake in the long run? Yeah, so we've got Assyria is a threat. So what does he do when Assyria comes on the scene? He tries to pay him off. Okay. And how does he get that money? He taxes the people. So he takes money from the people to pay a bribe to Assyria. Okay, so just looking ahead, now that we know that Assyria, I mean, we're at the end of his reign, we're 20 years away from exile. So obviously this isn't going to work in the long run. It's a short-term fix that really has major implications down the road. Okay, you can probably think of 100 examples of U.S. government policies that do that, right? We'll put a Band-Aid on it now, but then we're really going to have to deal with something in 20 years, right? Those kind of things. That's what he does. And on top of that, he sets up a policy where if I have to, of paying off other nations, word gets around on that, by the way. On top of that, what does Assyria think of Israel when they're paying a bribe? Weakness. It's a sign of weakness. It's almost like, yeah, we'll leave you alone for right now. But it's like any other conquering nation. It's any other appeasement policy, right? It's Neville Chamberlain in Europe in World War II, right? It's, you know, I mean, if you study that whole idea with Hitler as the Nazi Empire grew, you know, the nations that should have been there stopping him basically said, all right, we're going to draw a line. You better not cross it. And then Hitler would cross it, and they go, okay, well, we're going to draw this line. You better not cross that one, or there's going to be trouble. And Hitler would cross it, and they go, well, you better not come any further, or we're going to get really mad. You know, like, that was the appeasement policy, you know? Yeah, exactly. We could probably come up with some modern today sort of things that fit that category, right? Don't come any further. Okay, but you better not come any further. Well, we're in your living room now. You know, we've drawn so many lines, we're now sitting in your house. That's not a very good approach. Even if you are the weaker nation, it's not the approach, let alone if you're the more powerful nation. Okay. And, you know, we've got only one nation that's backed by the living God. So that shows you one thing about the lack of faith that's going on. So Menahem, I think, lays the foundation for disaster here. He lays the foundation for exile because religiously he does nothing to return Israel back. He still pushes that Jeroboam cult where they're worshiping all the other gods. His political activities put Israel in a precarious position. Pul, in verse 19, is a guy named Tiglath-Pileser. Tiglath-Pileser III, he's going to invade the he's going to be the king that puts Assyria back on the conquering in the conquering business. And his son will take it to the next level and go after all these nations. But Tiglath-Pileser is the guy that's going to push it forward when we move. He was known as Pul when he conquered Babylon. Babylon called him Pul, and that's why we've got it here in the scripture. Okay, so Menahem's strategy, this is what it made me think of, right? Because maybe it'll come to you if you know the movie. But it's to immediately pay the invaders a large sum of money to leave. No negotiation. No, you don't get this long, drawn out, hey, we'll do this, we'll do that. No, here's take my money and leave me alone. Okay? No, again, shows a lot of weakness. And Tiglath-Pileser is glad to take his money and leave. Okay, at the time, he's glad to take it and leave, but he's now armed with the knowledge that Israel has neither the power nor the will necessary to oppose him. Right? They don't even put up a fight. They just gave me money. You know, it's like I didn't even have to threaten them. All I had to do was show up and stand there and put my hand out, and they put money in my hand. You know, I didn't have to shake him down for his lunch money. All I had to do was show up, and he handed it over with no questions asked. And that sets it up. And so if you've ever seen the movie Tommy Boy, they're getting ready to go and negotiate these business things, and they're trying to get all hyped up and ready to go. And they're like, we're not going to take no for an answer. You know, and then every time they get in and sit down, they're like, nope, okay, see you later. You know, just keep walking out. All right, because he doesn't quite understand. Nope, okay, we're not even going to fight. We're going to walk out. Well, you're not getting business that way, and you're not going to negotiate many positive treaties that way either. So Menahem's levying of taxes to fund his appeasement begins the ongoing policy of draining Israel's resources, sometimes to fight Assyria and at other times to buy their favor. That's the other thing we'll see at the end of this chapter, is every now and then they'll get tired of paying off Assyria and they'll rise up and try to fight them. But now they don't have the resources necessary to fight because they've been paying them off for so many years. You see how this is a really ugly downward spiral for Israel. And plus, on top of that, you're just going to irritate Assyria. You know, now you made a deal, you went back on the deal. No, we want to make a deal again. Well, if they do make a deal with you the second time, they're going to charge you 10 times as much, right? I mean, you put yourself in a horrible position. So from now on, Israel will never be rid of Assyria. Menahem has simply whet their appetite for expansion and oppression. I mean, he's made them want to conquer them even more. In saving them for a period of years, he's doomed them for eternity, really, is what we're going to see when Assyria comes in and wipes them out. Okay, so let's get to his son. Pekahiah manages to get 2 years in, 23 through 26. In the 50th year of Azariah, king of Judah, I mean, see the contrast there? The king in Judah is there for 50 years, and these guys in Israel are 6 months, 1 month, 10 years, 2 years. Let's see. Pekahiah, son of Menahem, began to reign over Israel and Samaria, and he reigned 2 years, and he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. He did not turn away from the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which he made Israel sin. And Pekah, the son of Remaliah, his captain, conspired against him with 50 men of the people of Gilead and struck him down in Samaria. In the citadel of the king's house with Argob and Arieh, he put him to death and reigned in his place. Now the rest of the deeds of Pekahiah and all that he did, behold, they are written in the books, the chronicles of the kings of Israel. It's even more repetitive when we see it after three verses, right? You see how quickly this is going. All we get from the author is the length of his reign, 2 years, Pekahiah's support of the Jeroboam cult, and the events surrounding his assassination. In other words, nothing's really changed, and he didn't get anything done. He's killed off by one of his commanders. Israel's kings fail to lead. Assyria is lurking in the wings, and grasping power-hungry men kill kings and take their place. I mean, it is just chaos, and you've got enemies at the gates the entire time. Okay, they're fighting amongst themselves while the invading force is about to come in. All right, so let's move to Pekah in 1527 to 31. In the 52nd year of Azariah, king of Judah, Pekah, the son of Remaliah, began to reign over Israel and Samaria, and he reigned 20 years, and he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. He did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which he made Israel to sin. In the days of Pekah, king of Israel, Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, came and captured Ijon, Abel-Beth-Makkah, Genoa, Kedesh, Hazor, Gilead, and Galilee, all the land of Naphtali, and he carried the people captive to Assyria. So we've got our first example of exile going on here. Then Hoshea, the son of Elah, made a conspiracy against Pekah, the son of Remaliah, and struck him down and put him to death and reigned in his place in the 20th year of Jotham, the son of Uzziah. Now the rest of the acts of Pekah and all that he did, behold, they are written in the book of the Chronicles of the king of Israel. So here's the problem with these verses, is the years don't add up. If we're going on a strictly chronological basis, the years don't add up to 722, because everybody says with very little little leeway in it that Israel was exiled between 723 and 721. Everybody says that, conservative scholars, liberal scholars, no matter what, that's where we put it. If we go from 20 years from 740, that misses the date. So there must have been something going on here, because we assume that our author of Kings knows math, right? He's not stupid. He doesn't just put a random number in there for no reason, knowing it doesn't work. And so there must have been a situation where Pekah was in charge in another part of the country as some sort of co-regency. He was allowed to exist in power in different places. And anytime somebody has a coup, you know he's got backing from somewhere. So it makes sense that he could have reigned in a certain region of the country, and then he rises up. And so if we can move it back a little bit and do it that way, that's where the blue stuff comes from. He probably had some sort of rule from 752 to 740, and then he's the official king of Israel after he kills Pekahiah here, and he's the king of Israel from 740 to 732. Okay, not that unless you're a real history nerd, that probably doesn't concern you all that much. Okay, so again, there must be an explanation, and that's kind of what I talked about already. Right, so during Pekah's reign, Israel opposes Assyria. So when Pekah comes to power, he doesn't pay off Assyria; he tries to fight back. And so now you're just irritating Assyria. You know, you're like poking the lion at this point. And it's a policy that results the conflict known, that's why the spell check didn't get it, that results in the conflict known as the Syro-Ephraimite War. Yeah, you never even knew there was a Syro-Ephraimite War. It's Israel, led by Pekah, and Syria, led by Rezin, against Assyria. Okay, so Syria and Israel actually get together, these lifelong enemies get together to fight against Assyria. To strengthen their position, Israel and Syria seek to force Judah into joining the coalition. Edom and Philistia were also there. So think about that kind of coalition. The Philistines, the Edomites, the Syrians, and the Israelites. Quite an interesting grouping together. And they go to Judah and they say, "We want you to come in and help us too." And Judah says, "I can't join with you guys." And Judah calls Assyria. And Judah says, "These guys say they're going to attack me if I don't join them, so I need your help." And Tiglath-Pileser says, "Yeah, I'll help you out." And that's going to be next chapter. Okay, so Judah makes a deal with Assyria. So you talk about making deals with like the enemies of your enemies and that kind of thing. That always works out real well for governments too, right? But that's what we've got going on. We've got Israel siding with the Edomites, the Philistines, and the Syrians. And we've got Judah siding with the Assyrians, all in the same ugly political mix that's going on. Okay, so in the days of Pekah, king of Israel, Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, came and captured all these cities. Okay, there's some important cities in here. Hazor is in the Hula Valley. It's up north. It's where are we? Right here we go. Hazor is right there. Okay, it's the city that you need to guard this north pass if anybody came in from Syria. So when he takes that, that's a big strategic thing. Gilead's over here. He takes the Galilee, this whole region, the land of Naphtali. So they've got where Jesus did most of his ministry. That's the region that that Assyria comes in and takes. So the list of conquered towns of the west of the Jordan is not exhaustive, but it's representative. And the idea is that Assyria killed everybody. They took every town. Every town they wanted to take, they took. And they were in total control of Israel in the Upper Galilee, which is really the strategic position. They go all the way down. I think I've got a map. Yeah. You can't really see the lines very well, but you can see the invasion lines here. They actually go all the way down into Philistia and take a bunch of the Philistine lands. They get all the way to Megiddo here. That's the Battle of Armageddon, Megiddo, right? It is the important city when it comes to trade and travel going through the valley there. You've got to go through the Megiddo Pass. It is probably the most contested piece of real estate in the history of the world, and we're not done with it yet. There's still one more battle to happen there, right, if you've read Revelation. Okay, so all that goes, and they take Ramoth-Gilead over here. You see how far south they go. I mean, they've really got Israel in a vice at this point. That's to show that Assyria really takes him out pretty quickly. Okay? And he carried the people captive to Assyria. So what's the strategy? Why does Assyria deport people from nations that they come in and conquer? Because that's not, everybody doesn't do that. You know, sometimes you come in and you just take over the country and you oppress the people. Well, what's the strategy behind deporting people? You pretty much get rid of rebelliousness because there's no rebels to rebel anymore. They're all in another place. Exactly. Yeah, you've taken out the home field advantage, as it were. And on top of that, there's a demoralizing factor, right? You've been taken out of your homeland. And I think those are the two big things that we've got going on. It's to increase the Assyrian labor force. I get free labor. They go and do slave labor in my lands. And I reduce the possibility of opposition because there's nobody left to oppose me. And this is why those northern groups, the Sumerian groups, during Jesus' day, the people of Judah really looked down on the people of Samaria because they're not purebred Jews. They're people that were transported in. They would take people out and put people in from another area. And you've got a lot of what they would call half-breeds because they're not pure-blood Jews. And that's why they were looked at as dogs and everything else. And that's why Samaria has a whole different setup by the time Jesus comes on the scene. Okay, so Assyria's invasion of the land ravages the northernmost segment of Israel, leaving Pekah with no mandate for leadership and leading directly to his assassination at the hands of Hoshea. So poor leadership coupled with spiritual and social decline proves a deadly combination for Israel. Okay, that's from Ocean's 11, but it made me think of, if you've ever seen Ocean's 11, Bashir says, we're in Barney, right? And he says, what does that mean? We're in Barney rubble. We're in trouble, right? That's what's happening in Israel at this point. They're in Barney. Okay, this is bad. Because Hoshea is going to be the last one leading up to the final king, which is going to lead to Assyria coming in and taking them out. Meanwhile, in Judah, the ultimate downfall will occur more slowly, which is interesting because Judah is weaker than Israel. Remember, we kind of covered that. Judah was down to nothing when it came to armies a few chapters back. They're almost as corrupt, and they're certainly no wiser than the North is. They've just got guys that are kind of mediocre and apathetic. The North has guys that really chase corrupt things. But they do have a consistently pro-Assyrian policy, which is going to kind of stay their execution for a little while. Their destruction won't come until later, but the seeds are being sown right now. Their weakness is being sown right now as well. Okay, and we probably don't have time for all this today, but we're getting close. So we'll end there, and we'll cover that last chapter next week, and then we will be on to the exile where things should get a little more exciting. All right, let's close in prayer. Father, thank you for today. Thanks for this time and your word. Tough historical section a little bit, but I pray that it was a profitable for us as we learn more about you and the history of your word and everything else of the nation of your people. Bless the service at 10:45, Lord, the groundbreaking ceremony, everything else that we've got going on today. May you get all the glory for it. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you, guys.